This is Fresh Air. This year, Annie Proulx went from literary obscurity to literary fame. Her first novel, Postcards, which was published last year, won this year's Pen Faulkner Award. Her second novel, The Shipping News, won this year's National Book Award. Proulx may be a newcomer to novels, but she's no youngster. She's 58, has raised 3 sons, and most of her life struggled to make a living writing for magazines. Proulx lives in Vermont. Most of her latest novel, The Shipping News, is set in Newfoundland, where the main character writes a shipping news column for the local weekly paper. Before Proulx reads an excerpt, here's her description of the main character, Coyle.
Coyle, who is in his 30s when this story begins, is a lurching, out-of-sync, big, fat, heavy fellow who doesn't think well of himself and who just stumbles through life. And nothing works for him. It's as though he's on a one-way train to nowhere.
And why did you make him a big, fat fellow?
I wanted him to be awkward. I wanted him to have that body bulk to handle in addition to his other problems. I wanted him not to fit in literally to the spaces that the rest of the world around him fit into. I just wanted him to be completely out of sync. And that was one way to do it.
Did you want him to ever lose weight?
No, I wanted him to come to grips with it, and with the people and the people around him to just take him for what he was. I didn't want him to turn into a Prince Charming at all, except in an interior sense and in terms of his own regard for his abilities and skills.
So let me ask you to read a passage from the beginning, not the very beginning, but a few pages in from The Shipping News, and you might want to set this up.
This is poor Coyle, who has everything in his life has gone wrong. His parents have committed suicide. His wife has run off and left him. His best friend has moved away. His children have been sold to a child pornographer. And here he is in this wretched town of Mockingburg, where he works, where he is about to find work as a third-rate newspaper man. Here's the description of Coyle at the beginning of the story. Coyle, stuck in bedraggled Mockingburg, a place in its third death, stumbled in 200 years from forests and woodland tribes to farms, to a working-class city of machine tool and tire factories. A long recession emptied the downtown, killed the malls, factories for sale, slum streets, youths with guns in their pockets, political word rattle of some litany, sore mouths and broken ideas. Who knew where the people went? Probably California. Coyle bought groceries at the A&B grocery, got his gas at the D&G convenience, took the car to the R&R garage when it needed gas or new belts. He wrote his pieces, lived in his rented trailer, watching television. Sometimes he dreamed of love. Why not? A free country. When Ed Punch fired him, he went on binges of cherry ice cream, canned ravioli. He abstracted his life from the Times. He believed he was a newspaper reporter, yet read no paper except the Mockingburg Record, and so managed to ignore terrorism, climatological change, collapsing governments, chemical spills, plagues, recession, and failing banks, floating debris, the disintegrating ozone layer, volcanoes, earthquakes, and hurricanes, religious frauds, defective vehicles, and scientific charlatans, mass murderers and serial killers, tidal waves of cancer, AIDS, deforestation, and exploding aircraft were as remote to him as braid catches, canyons, and rosette-embroidered garters. Scientific journals spewed reports of mutant viruses, of machines pumping life through the near dead, of the discovery that the galaxies were streaming apocalyptically toward an invisible great attractor, like flies into a vacuum cleaner nozzle. That was the stuff of others' lives. He was waiting for his to begin.
Well, that might give our listeners a sense of why you've been winning all these awards. that's pretty good. I want to just read a very brief description of his wife, the wife who has just left him and will soon be killed in a car crash. You describe her as, you say, at night she became a woman who could not be held back from strangers' rooms, who would have sexual conjunction whether in stinking restrooms or mop cupboards. Did you know women like her?
Do I personally know women like her?
Yeah.
Not many. I suppose that the wild sexual woman flies across everyone's vision from time to time. So yes, I think in the past I've known women who were vaguely like Petal.
Tell me why you created her.
She was exactly what Coyle needed at this point in his life. I needed a really unhappy situation for him, and so I gave him this quicksilver, rather mad person who cared nothing for her children. And I just wanted to get Coyle with his kids off to Newfoundland, and Petal was the quickest way to do that.
Now, he works for, once he gets to Newfoundland, he starts to work on another weekly paper. Now, you've worked on weekly papers, right? Small-town weeklies?
I was involved with a small paper in Vermont called Behind the Times years ago. I started it, and it was actually a monthly rather than a weekly, but I've known a lot of people in my life who have worked on dailies, weeklies, that sort of thing. So I know a lot of newspaper people, and it's a wonderful way to cover a social situation, to use a newspaper in a book if you want to cover the events of the times. This is an excellent way to use it.
If you don't mind, I'm going to skip ahead to the very last sentence of the shipping news. And I don't think the sentence reveals very much in the way of plot. But the sentence is, "And it may be that love sometimes occurs without pain and misery." Is that something you've hoped, or does that reflect anything on your experience?
My own personal experience?
Yeah.
Oh, no. I've always been marvelously happy. it's there because, again, this wretched Coyle who gets through life and somehow things work round for him. Well, actually, it goes back a little farther than that. Let me back up a bit. When I wrote The Postcards, which was my first novel, a lot of people came up to me and said, "Oh, I love that book, but it was so sad. It was just so painful." And I began to get the idea, I heard it enough times, I began to get the idea that people really wanted a happy ending. And so I thought to myself in a rather sardonic manner, "Happy ending, eh? All right, we'll do a book with a happy ending."
So that's the happiest you could come up with, the hope that perhaps there is happiness.
Well, for Coyle, this is a happy ending, the absence of pain.
Right.
But the story is worked out in such a way that the reader is not conscious that it isn't really a happy ending. People accept it as a happy ending, even though it's a very modest happiness.
My guest is Annie Prue. Her novel, The Shipping News, won this year's National Book Award. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with novelist Annie Prue. Now, your first novel, Postcards, that's the one that won the Penn Faulkner Award,
yes,
Award earlier this year.
Correct.
Describe for us how Postcards figure into the novel.
Postcards were a device, and they preface each section. There is a handwritten postcard from one character or another that carries a short personal message but also moves the story along in a way. And the reason I used those postcards was, one, to involve the reader in the book, because everybody loves to read postcards. It pulls the reader into the story and makes the reader fill in between the lines with imagining the characters. And the second reason was because I had a lot of different places in this book. It really is a march across North America. And the postcards were one way of getting that geographical span to work. It also allowed me to move between different voices and different periods of time very economically. The whole book is laid out in 4 decades, so that we move from the 1940s to the contemporary period. And we do it a little subtly or indicate the time changes subtly by using the postcards with different dates.
Was there an incident that got you thinking about postcards?
Oh, years ago someone had given me a handful of postcards that were that featured the photographs of prisoners on one side and a description of their crimes on the other. These were escapees from the then Vermont State Prison. And they were extremely fascinating to me, just these mug shots. And I carried them around with me for a long time, maybe 8 or 10 years before I even started to think of writing a novel. They were just something that was extremely interesting to me. And then it just popped into my head when I started to write this novel that those postcards were very powerful. And while I never used them, I never used prison escapee postcards, I did use the postcards proper.
I've never heard of prison escapee postcards before.
Probably something that only happened in Vermont and only for a short period.
Who were they mailed to?
I think they went to the sheriffs in each county. I think a packet of them would be stuffed in an envelope. I don't think they went out singly through the mails openly and naked. I think a bunch of them were shoved into an envelope and sent to local sheriffs, be on the watch for these fellows.
So how did you make a living before you started earning a living as a writer?
Well, I didn't make a living before I started earning a living as a writer. I went back to school when I was in my late 20s to study history and did graduate work at Sir George Williams in Montreal, which is now Concordia University, and promptly found myself, when I finished that, decided I didn't want to be an historian, but I found myself absolutely unable to get a job. I was overqualified for everything in the state of Vermont. I kept applying and applying, so I ended up with lousy jobs of slinging hash or working in pizza joints, this kind of thing, because I couldn't get a job for which I was qualified. And at that point, I started writing. I was living up north near the Canadian border, and I started writing. It was a way that I could make some money and exist.
Were you already a mother then?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
So did you usually not have a whole lot of money when you were raising your kids?
I did not have a whole lot of money when I was raising my kids, that's for sure. I've never had a whole lot of money. But so what? Most people don't.
Right. It sounds like you, in fact, though, had very little.
There were times in my life when I had very little, yes. There was a period in my life when I was living with a friend on the Canadian border, when we spent a lot of time hunting and gathering and fishing. That was a real eye-opener, very interesting way to live.
How did you get by easily with it?
No, you don't get by easily doing it that way. You spend an enormous amount of time in pursuit of food.
Have you often been considered the town eccentric where you've lived?
No. I can't think why I would be.
Oh, okay.
This is Vermont.
Meaning?
Vermont has lots of town eccentrics. And when I was doing this back-to-nature trip, I was up on the Canadian border. I was in a very, very rural place. And most Vermont towns that I've lived in, I've been in a very rural situation where you don't have nearby neighbors who watch your comings and goings and so forth.
Now that you've gotten all these awards this year, are you nervous about writing? Do you feel that there's something you're supposed to be living up to now, that your work will be judged differently? It's easy to lose your equilibrium after something like that.
Right. Well, my work may indeed be judged differently, but since I don't know any different way to write, I'll just have to go ahead doing it the way I've always done it. It's because my interest in the lives of my characters has always been greater than in my own life or remembering details of my life, I don't think there's going to be a problem. I'm absolutely wild to get back to work on that book, on Accordion Crimes.
Maybe that's what you just said is an obvious thing for anybody who writes fiction. But why are your characters' lives more interesting to you than your own memories?
I have no idea. I haven't the slightest clue. They just are. I spend almost no time brooding over my own past or thinking on past incidents. I forget my past at once, as soon as it's happened, unless I'm forced into a corner and made to remember it. It's just not interesting to me.
Is that a good thing? I mean, so much of us are almost morbidly self-involved and are always analyzing our past and how it's affecting our present and what our parents did when they were bringing us up and so on. Is it liberating to not be thinking about that?
I think so. It seems so to me. I'd really much rather put the energy and keenness into making these paper characters. How to describe it? It's like having an enormous and tremendously difficult crossword puzzle in front of you, and the finishing of this crossword puzzle can take a year or two. And writing a novel to me is like going daily to that puzzle and working it and rearranging it. Crossword puzzle isn't a very good comparison. But one's own life, I mean, it has already happened. You can't rearrange the events of the past the way you can rearrange a novel.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you, Terry.
Annie Prue is the author of Postcards and The Shipping News. She spells her last name P-R-O-U-L-X. This is Fresh Air.